The other one is The Big Chill, a film from, I think, the early 1980s. Again, doesn't have a soundtrack. It's just using a whole lot of older pop songs, particularly sort of 60s, 70s soul songs, which are supposed to be referring, I suppose, to the kind of nostalgic film. This kind of compilation score, I don't think that Hollywood invented it by any means. I think it existed in a number of other film industries, including China. There was a tradition of a compilation score in Chinese films. Where Hollywood transformed it was that it turned it into such an important revenue stream. So you start to see soundtrack albums for things like Breakdance, another 1980s film, selling tens of millions of copies, starts to become an incredibly important cross-promotional tool. Even something like Baz Luhrmann's film Romeo and Juliet. And again, it's an interesting example. This is a film done in 1996, so it was one of Leonardo DiCaprio's first films, became quite popular. It was a film that, it's interesting, a lot of the post-production of that film was done in Melbourne, even though the film was a Hollywood production. It was just the beginning of digital technology and the capacity to sort of send things all around the place. And one thing they did was to release a soundtrack album, which wasn't really stuff that was in the film. It was sort of stuff that the filmmaker, the director, liked. And so people who saw the film, it was a very popular film, marketed to young people, so they put a lot of pop songs in it to draw in the young audience. And the soundtrack album was so popular, they released a second one. Nothing to do with the film. Again, just things that the film, it was songs picked by the film director that were branded through the success of the film. So you start to see the way in which film and music offer very rich cross-promotional opportunities. And you imagine, particularly in the context of the dominance of the film industry by five or six large film studios, some of which have music divisions like Sony and Warner Brothers, they see the potential between this kind of cross-promotion as very beneficial to them. Okay. Now, the last bit of this talk, which I'll try and do in a hurry because I realise we're getting to the end of our time, is really about the digitisation of sound. And I think this is an example or a trajectory that pulls in a number of different directions. I talk about the dominance of the recording music industry. There's a big four that dominate most of the popular music released around the world. Big four recording companies. But they haven't always been all that smart. In the 1980s, the emergence of music television, MTV, in the United States really took them by surprise. That wasn't something they were on top of. The music industry got a lot of profits in the 1980s with the first emergence of digital formats, the CD. Anybody remember CDs? Soon, no. What the music industry did in the 1980s was they released a lot of their back catalogue material from the 1960s, the 1970s, even the 1950s, and they found that people would buy this material and pay reasonably high prices. And this was just, as we say, money for jam. They were getting good money without any cost. To produce a CD wasn't expensive. They already had the content. They didn't have to pay the artists very much. They were selling all this back catalogue stuff. But then the digital revolution turned around to bite them. Very connected to the film industry. Trying to develop the standards for digitising film, the MP4 standard that I'm showing you all these film clips on, one of the things that it does is produce a compression technology for squeezing file sizes for sound. Everybody heard of MP3? That's what came out of the film compression technology. It was a kind of side effect of film compression technology. And in the mid-1990s, people discover, as the internet spreads, that you can actually, when you've got digitized formats like the CD, you can get the files off them pretty easily, and you can distribute them pretty easily. Suddenly the cost of distributing music goes through the floor. Before that, there was some music piracy with audio cassettes and so on, but nothing like what happened in the last decade and a half. So around 1998-99, there's a service that emerged in the United States called Napster, which really showed the music industry, I suppose, and scared the music industry, how people could distribute music very easily using peer-to-peer systems or semi-peer-to-peer systems, you know, just one person's computer sending to another computer and so on. So this is one way in which digitization of music has turned around to damage the industry in a sense. Actually, I want to show you this slide. If you look at this, it's not worldwide statistics, but it's statistics for how music is sold in Australia from 1982 to 2011. You see the green one is vinyl albums, the old LP, long playing records. It just goes and virtually disappears. The blue one is cassettes, the cassette format. Again, it goes down and it does disappear. Vinyl doesn't completely disappear because DJs keep buying vinyl and using vinyl in that. The CD takes off 1982. They're selling enormous numbers, 50 million units. For a country the size of Australia, that's a lot. But then it starts to go down. They've sold their back catalogues off, and it's going down. And here, around 2004, 2005, you're starting to see legal digital downloads. And you look at the rise on that. I mean, it's a bit misleading because you're not talking about downloading a whole album. You're talking about track downloads, so you're going to have a higher number. But you can see where the industry is heading. It's heading entirely towards digital downloads. So the problem that the music industry has, and the film industry has, they've got this very popular cross-promotional model. They know you can market music through film. You can bring audiences to films through music. Their problem now is how do they actually recover the revenues? How do they monetize it? Because they're not getting people to pay for those downloads in many cases. I think this is an issue for the industries worldwide. They've had to accept much lower margins. If we go and think about how digital technology has affected sound production, I think the story is very different. And again, it's a transition that happened very rapidly. You can see this kind of rapid takeoff of the CD. Digital technology in sound production in the film industry really comes in the early 1990s, around 1992 in Australia. And by 1995, no one was using analog sound anymore. Everybody was using digital sound and digital post-production. I think there's two or three key reasons for this. Has anybody worked with analog tape here? I doubt that you would, but maybe someone has. If you want to edit from analog tape, old-fashioned tape recorder or old-fashioned video recorder, and you make a copy of the sound, the copy you make is worse quality. It's what we call a generation. It's a first generation or a second generation or a third generation copy. Each time you copy the sound from the original tape, you lose some quality. With digital audio tape or with a digital file, you make the copy of the sound, it's the same as the original. You don't lose quality. So for sound practitioners, this is a big issue. I think there were other issues that when you were recording on an old-fashioned tape recorder, the recorder might have been this size. You might have had tape reels like this. The industry standard was a machine called a Nagra. And you might end up with a whole shelf full of reels of sound tape, all this big. And when you want to make your soundtrack, you have to get that reel, you have to record a little bit of that one, then you have to get that reel, you have to put it on, wind it, record a little bit, and so on. There's a lot of physical labour, it takes a lot of space, it's slow. Suddenly it was being done not on a computer as small as this, but on, you know, an Avid sound tool, which is now Pro Tools, which is the industry standard. So on a relatively small workstation, you could have all your files digitized. You weren't degrading them when you were doing multiple dubs. So the whole process of producing sound and of layering sounds together to produce complex soundtracks became much easier. You can work faster. And I think one of the things we've seen is that this hasn't been used to save money. It's been used to produce more complex, better soundtracks. And that's simply to do with the competition in the industry. That if you're wanting to compete with home viewing, with television, the screens are getting bigger, they're getting stereo sound and now home theatre sound and so on. What you produce in the theatre has to be even better. So, I think I want to finish up here with a number of points. And I was talking a little while ago about the movement to all digital cinema. Digital capture with a camera, whether that's a high definition camera or a lower definition digital camera. Digital processing, picture editing, sound editing, special effects and so on. And then digital projection in the cinema. This has been an idea that's been around for probably 10 years now, that we will have all digital cinema quite soon. But there's always been a problem, at least in the Hollywood business model. If you want to put in a high-quality digital projector that's as good a quality as 35mm film, the projector's going to probably cost you $100,000 per screen. If you're a theatre exhibitor and you own 100 screens or 300 screens or something, that's a lot of money you've got to pay. And you say to the distributor, I don't want to pay that. I've got a film projector that cost me $20,000. It's lasted me 20 years. It works perfectly well. I make money. Why should I pay that? In fact, all the benefit is going to go to the distributor who no longer has to make celluloid reels of film to send around to the theatres. So there's been a long argument going on over who's going to pay for the re-equipping of the theatres. There's also been a problem that we see a lot with computer technology, with digital technology. Different companies produce different proprietary standards. Apple produce their computer and they'll only run certain types of files, certain types of video files. Other companies will produce their types of computers. They all want to own the market, but a lot of the files won't work universally. So the film industry gets very nervous about this because for 100 years, film has been very international as a medium. You can shoot on cameras, film cameras in any country. You can buy film stock in any country. And you can show the result on a projector in any country. It didn't really matter. It was what we call interoperable. All the systems operated together. And it's proved very hard to recreate this interoperability in relation to digital. That you have to have servers, you have to have encryption standards, you have to have resolution standards for sound and for image and so on. The American studios got together in 2004 or thereabouts. The major studios formed a consortium called Digital Cinema Initiatives, or DCI, to attempt to establish standards for the American film industry with the idea that they thought everybody else would be forced to follow because of their dominant position. They finally, actually, they were established in 2002. They finally released their specification for digital theatre in 2005. It's very interesting to see what's happened in the last 5 or 6 years. For a long time, digital theatre didn't really take off, even in the US, because no one saw a business model for doing it. In the last 2 or 3 years, it's really taken off. And now more than 50% of the cinemas in the US are all digital. They have digital projection. The primary driving force of that has been 3D. Everybody wants to watch movies in 3D, and they can get a bigger ticket price, maybe $2 or $3 extra on the ticket price to see a 3D film, so the distributors see a reason to put in digital equipment. But the idea of having a unified standard hasn't happened, even in the US. A lot of the theatres are not DCI compliant, let alone in other countries. Certainly in China, in Asia, where there's been the fastest growth of cinemas, new cinemas, over the last 10 or 15 years, a lot of those theatres have very different equipment. Many of them aren't replacing a traditional cinema. They're just a new installation with maybe a lower resolution digital projector. Second thing about digital cinema, for theatres, it's actually not a very big market. When we think about consumer goods, we think about markets in the millions or tens of millions of units. But there's only about 130,000 cinema screens worldwide. So if you're wanting to change the equipment for digital cinemas, these kinds of projectors, but you're wanting to make them high-definition projectors capable of producing a very large-scale, good-quality image, you're not actually talking about that big a market. The spin-off technology that's made the money for companies like DLP, Digital Light Processing, which make the high-definition cinema projectors, has been home projection technology. It's been domestic projection. Third thing I wanted to say is that in terms of the integration of the music and film industry, over the last 20 or so years, the proportion of revenue that is taken by a film when it's playing at a film theatre has been going down. More and more of the revenue a film takes over its life is taken in different exhibition windows. Television, DVD, other viewing opportunities. But also a whole range of ancillary marketing. And this is where the move into new media, to games, to toys, that is much more part of the revenue stream of a film than it used to be. I think that's why very successful franchises have been established around, say, animation, digital animation, using music, using voiceover, or taking Broadway musicals. Something like The Lion King would be a good example, where you take a musical, you turn it into a film. The Lion King as a film did very well at the box office. It takes maybe $500 million at the box office, but it's ancillary merchandising, T-shirts, toys, etc., is probably 5-6 times that. So most of the money actually comes not from the film in the theatre, but from other product streams. Biggest change in the film in the music industry over the last few years has been the emergence of iTunes. iTunes is now the largest music distributor in the world. It's very interesting to look at Apple's revenue. iTunes was originally established not to make money for Apple, to drive clients to buy iPods. Remember the iPod back at... Where's the iPod? Back here. This is from 2009. So this is their revenue from computers. It's pretty flat. They start to make revenue from iPods. They don't make much revenue from the iTunes store. That's the yellow stream. They don't actually have the iTunes store to make money. They have it to drive customers onto their devices, iPods, iPads. Where are they making their revenue now? From the iPhone? That's most of it. And from the iPad. So this is a very big change in the music industry, that they have to deal with a technology company like Apple. They were the first company that got deals with all of the big music distributors. I think the music distributors licensed iTunes because it was such a small part of the computer industry. Apple had, what, 3% of the home computer market. So they thought it would be a test case. They thought they wouldn't really be risking much if they licensed their content to iTunes. But then the iPod took off, and then the iPhone took off. And increasingly, people started to buy music through iTunes. Now it's the, as I said, the largest music distributor in the world. The music companies aren't very happy about this because they don't make much revenue from the iTunes store. And the artists, the music artists, are even less happy because they make even less money. iTunes doesn't sell albums, not very much, you know, whole CDs. It sells tracks, single tracks. And this has been another very big change in the industry. So as I said, the film industry has now got a big issue as to how does it actually build this relationship between film and music in a way that can make money, because they've found actually they've in a way been hijacked by a company like Apple, who is making money by selling devices and who don't care whether they make money from the content or not. They use the content in order to get people to buy the devices. Now that might be a good place to stop because we've run out of time, so I will finish there. Thank you.